Welcome to another episode of Decoded by Marriott Digital Services, bringing you the smartest minds, best leaders in the digital space. And here we produce a 10-part series on all things digital marketing. This is episode 7. My name is Mike. I'm Director of Program Management. I'm joined by Chris Robinson, Director of Customer Success.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Doing well. And we have a special guest for our news roundtable. After a good deal of fanfare, we're bringing it back for a second week in a row. And we are joined by our account manager from BrightEdge, Ryan Goltzman. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Mike. Hey, Chris. Good morning. Thanks for having me on today.
Thanks for joining us. So we live and breathe BrightEdge every day as a department. But for those that may not know, what is BrightEdge?
Sure. BrightEdge is the industry-leading SEO digital content marketing platform, working with the largest, most strategic brands in the world, helping guide their organic strategies, their paid strategies, content writing strategies, everything sort of under that umbrella. And yeah, we are the leader in the space and get to work with really cool, large, innovative brands like Marriott.
Awesome. Yeah, it's nothing to sneeze at. It's a tool that we've been using for, I mean, at least over half a decade, maybe even a decade at this point. So great to have you with us today. And then Ryan, just for some context, could you tell us a little bit about your role at BrightEdge and what you do so people know the perspective you bring to things?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a strategic account manager at BrightEdge, working at our global business unit. And what that means is that I work with some of the largest, most strategic brands all over the world. And I'm really lucky I get to work with brands not only all over the world, but in a variety of industries. So I am kind of always trying to understand my clients' needs and challenges and problems and favorite appetizers and drinks at the bar. But also, you know, because of that, I need to keep my finger on the pulse of a variety of news outlets, right? Kind of all over the world. And that's exactly why I'm excited to be here today, because this is stuff that I'm, you know, reading up on essentially every morning and, you know, hoping to add to the podcast that you guys have, you know, successfully launched over the last few weeks. And yeah, excited for today.
All right. Well, let's jump into it. Thanks again, Ryan. So we'll go through a couple stories, but we'll start with kind of a light topic. So I think we all know we more or less have crossed the anniversary of the COVID pandemic for the year. And so much has changed over the last year for everybody, from, you know, professional to personal. Everything in between is kind of upside down, and hopefully some normalcy is back with us soon. But I want to talk a little bit about something that I have found oddly comforting through all of this. So I think we've all probably picked up some new habits, good or bad, through all of this. Ryan, I think I heard you say before we went on air that you're meditating now, which is fantastic.
I'm
kind of back into it. I need to up my game again, but that's not for debate today. So I thought it might be cool to kind of share what are some things that we've all gotten into that maybe give us a little bit of comfort of the old days or old ways of life. I'll start. It's kind of a strange one. So I cut the cord back in August. So we went from traditional cable over to just streaming services. It's going super well. You know, everything from your Netflix to your Prime to your Hulu to your classics. And then I also found some kind of bizarre ones too. There's one called Pluto TV, and it's by Paramount, who the folks that own CBS and Nickelodeon and all that stuff. And instead of your traditional streaming platform of you pay them $8 to $15 a month, and then you get, you know, what you know is a streaming service, this is more or less like fake TV. So there's like 500 channels. They're all kind of themed together. And there's kind of these odd takes on what a channel could be. So for example, there isn't Travel Channel, there's Adventure Channel, right? There isn't Nickelodeon, there is like Nick on Pluto. So there's kind of like brand variations that sit in there. So this is kind of cruising through, and I found really old episodes of an Anthony Bourdain show, which I quite like. And then I came across one called Hotel Impossible. Do you guys remember this show?
No. I do. Didn't watch it very much, to be honest.
Nor did I. And the gist is more or less it's kind of your fixer type guy, very polished type of guy. So the one that would normally go into a restaurant or a bar or whatever. But instead of those, he's going and fixing hotels that need a lot of work. And I remember seeing this when it first came out, and I did not like it at all, right? I thought the guy was like brash, crude, arrogant, which definitely the gist, right? You want to kind of hate the host. But I got to say, seeing someone walk into hotels, talk to guests, enjoy or not enjoy the hotel room, the views and everything has been oddly satisfying of just seeing like, here's a little bit of the world that I've missed. And, you know, hopefully we can get folks traveling again, so folks can get back into obviously good hotel rooms, not the ones that are focused in this show. But it got me thinking, Chris, what's something that you've, you know, turned to for comfort or normalcy out of all of this?
Well, I mean, I've not seen the show that you're mentioning. It's very similar to a show in the UK called The Hotel Inspector. And it was run by a daughter of a guy, and I can't remember who it was, but she kind of did the same thing, right? And I remember going to a wedding once, and we stayed in one of those hotels, and it wasn't as good as what the TV show made it out to be at the end. Let's just put it that way. The public areas were really nice. One bedroom was really nice, but everything else was a little bit bad. I think for me, like it was actually yesterday, and we were, myself and Ryan, we were all talking about barbecue just before we got on recording, and we were joking around like, oh, why can't you control it from your phone or your watch? And yesterday I cooked on my Weber, which was like traditional charcoal, like lighting the fire, like that type of thing. And I left, I was like, oh, wow, that was fun. Like it was so much better than cooking through a phone. So I guess not really kind of loosely related to technology, but nothing to do with hotels. So I would say my charcoal Weber barbecue.
It counts.
It does.
What about yourself, Ryan?
Oh, wow. Technology related. I don't know if I've necessarily gone back to the basics with anything, but, you know, we have a car in Astoria. Not a lot of people in the city have a car, and I haven't driven this much this regularly since I was like in high school. I feel like I have my license again. Every weekend, my wife and I, we go on hour, 2 hour, 3 hour drives. Now I'm going on hikes, you know, checking out local breweries in the middle of nowhere, really just trying to, you know, live a little dangerously, if you will, right? Not necessarily looking at the map, just trying to driving around that, you know, take a left up here. That looks like a cool street. So a little bit of that I haven't done in quite a long time. You know, back in the day, you were printing out directions on MapQuest. You know, you weren't really looking at your phone for directions and taking orders from Google Maps or Siri or anybody. So if anything, it's been trying to unplug a little bit and just drive, throw on the radio, have a good time.
Nice. Well, it's good to see the New Yorker still knows how to drive a car. So
I do.
That's a great transition to our first topic, which is a little bit more news-ish. So I think everybody here in travel knows about Focusrite and Focuswire. They're one of the big travel news wires that just exists out there. They publish a lot of really good trend data, research data, case studies, and then they've got like a news division too, right? So it caught my eye from a couple months back. They released their hot 25 startups for 2021. So these are in theory exciting travel startups that you know, largely the list is comprised of what's been new and exciting since the pandemic happened, right? Like years ago, you may have seen something like a kayak or a Hipmunk on one of these lists. But this year they're largely tuned to what has been disrupted through the pandemic and what's really hitting in travel. So we'll go through and we'll pick our top three or one that each jumps out to each of us. But the one that I picked is called Dream Drive. So it's ironically a little close to what Ryan was talking about. And this is a company, they're based in Japan, where they basically have created through partnerships custom vans that sleep somewhere between 2 and 4 people and come with all of the gear or accoutrement, whatever you want to say, to basically go on a road trip. It includes everything from your, you know, places you can keep food. It includes your bedding. It includes all the stuff you need to basically just like hit the road for a couple of days and go out and drive. and really enjoy, you know, a road trip in a specific area. And I thought this was pretty cool. And the other thing that they do too is they also have an ecosystem of camps around airports so that you can basically drive from place to place, drop your van if you want to, jump on a plane and kind of just keep doing the same thing. So it's a pretty cool concept. I have no idea if it's going to survive past the next year or so. And again, it's only in Japan, but it kind of shows you the ingenuity of people wanting to get out. And in the case, Ryan, it seems pretty up your speed for getting out and moving. What jumps out to you?
I've always wanted to rent a camper. I've definitely always wanted to rent a camper and drive cross country, but I don't know if I'm built for that, but this is definitely an interesting idea. And my one that I picked was pretty similar to this, actually. It's called Tenter. It's essentially the Airbnb of camping, or what I like to do, glamping, which is essentially camping with a really nice tent. And maybe even an aero bed. So Tenter actually started in 2019. And it's essentially, like I said, the Airbnb of glamping, and it's made it really experiential. You can book through the website Tenter, or you can actually book through Expedia and Airbnb. So, you know, during the last year of confinement, people have been looking for ways to get out, nature walks, hiking, going to a brewery. And I saw in a recent study by Campground of America that 43% of leisure travelers say that they're planning to spend more time outdoors, and it's important to them because of the pandemic. So this sort of fits right in. And I'm really excited about this because it's not only great for the would-be camper, but it's a unique experience and brings business to these people that are offering up their land for this glamping experience. And very similar to the startup that you brought up, Mike, they sort of take the difficulty out of camping. You're not pitching your own tent. You're not running to Walmart to buy emergency charcoal or first aid kits. They kind of set you up for success. You've got the Adirondack chairs, the fire pit set up, and you kind of just pull up, check in with your host, and that's it. So I know that when I am ready to travel again, you know, I'm certainly going to be staying in a hotel. But if I am interested in camping, I'm absolutely going to be exploring Tenter.
That sounds like one that's definitely going to stay around, right? Like, I feel like everybody's been a little bit more flavor for the outdoors through all of this. So as a Boy Scout, I want that one to stay around. So,
yeah, I know that anytime that I've planned a camping trip, it's always a little confusing and challenging to find the right site, find the right gear, you know, where's my sleeping bag? And again, they sort of, you know, take that all out.
I picked a company called Beachy. So Beachy is a software company ultimately that kind of combines mapping technology and reservation and payment systems, so guests can reserve spots on their beaches or by their pools. So like lounge chairs or umbrellas or cabanas or whatever it might be. And it's all contactless. So, you know, hotels can then control their capacity and they can social distance their chairs and their, you know, everything on their beaches, and also importantly drive additional revenue for the property as well, which is always a good thing. And even without a global pandemic, I could totally absolutely get behind reserving something like this. So it's similar to a company that actually we work with at Merrick called Real Time Reservations, and they do pool booking cabanas, but it can also be expanded to other services like gyms or public spaces or whatever it might be. And I think I look back to, we stayed in a hotel probably for the first time in a year in early February, and the experience was wonderful. I think that's, you know, you look back and you think that's why I work in travel, because of that type of experience. However, when you check in, they're like, the gym is on appointment only, and you have to call reception every time you want a reservation. And so I called, and I got a time slot for my children to go swimming. I go and tell my wife, and she's like, well, that's too early. And I was like, oh, okay. So then I call reception again, and like, well, you know, and it's constantly playing this like phone tag situation between everyone, whereas if you just had it online, it would be so much more simpler. So I think absolutely get behind a company like this, and I'm glad that things like the pandemic have escalated technology in this way to be able to offer services like this that people may not have had access to 12 months ago.
That's a great one too, because I think one thing that's changed with my behavior is like, I expect I can pre-book anything in this world at this point, and I would like that very much to stay around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and lugging, you know, lugging the chairs and the cooler and all that fun stuff to the beach and finding out there's no good spots anywhere is probably the most frustrating experience one can have. So being able to book that spot ahead of time, that's definitely going to save a lot of biceps from tearing and you know, save some family fights, right, down at the beach.
All right. So next article, I think, Ryan, is right up your alley. So I think everyone knows that Google has a pending update called Core Vitals coming out. It's supposed to hit later this spring, early summer. And it's actually an algorithm update or a set of factors that Google is going to look at that they actually, in fact, delayed. So it was supposed to come out in 2020. But given there's a very large lift required for webmasters and companies to kind of get ready for Core Vitals, they actually decided to move it into 2021. And I've been doing SEO almost 10 years, and I've never heard of Google delaying an algorithm update for more than a week, besides something like there's a bug in the tech versus pushing it back for over a year so people could prepare. And Core Vitals is the simplest way to describe it is it's a large update around speed, performance, and user experience related to largely mobile web, right? So I'm sure everybody at this point with the internet and the mobile web is very irritated by the fact that everything literally pops up. There's ads everywhere, there's cookies everywhere. You'll load a page and then 3 seconds later, the entire layout has shifted, buttons have moved around, and all those types of things that, frankly, as a user, kind of irritate me. And I'm glad Google's kind of starting to take a little bit of a stance on this and put some weight behind it. But it is a pretty substantial change because it has a lot to do with how pages load, how they render, the speed they go through, and then what the impact to the user is. And Google was saying that, you know, now that they've delayed it, they're feeling comfortable, they're going to launch it. But what they also then outlined this week is that the data that's behind Core Vitals takes about a month to populate, right? So there's about a month lag between when they basically will not crawl a website, but determine and basically do this check, because there's a lot of manual stuff they need to do to find this data, or pulse it, however you want to phrase it, right? But as we move into a world where Core Vitals is going to hit soon, and then we know the data is a little bit delayed, what do we think about that, Ryan? Is that par for the course with Google, or is this something that we should be a little frustrated by?
Well, waiting for the data is definitely something that is par for the course. However, this update in general is quite the opposite. You know, like you said, Google rarely gives this much of a runway towards a major algorithm update like this, let alone so much, not fanfare, but attention to it, right? I know here at BrightEdge, you know, we're having a webinar this week with all of our larger, more strategic clients specifically because of this. Good plug, right? But no, in all seriousness, this is something that needs to be taken very seriously because of the runway that Google's given. The fact that data will be in a delay at first, again, that's not surprising, but we know that there are some companies that have been planning for this for, you know, the better part of a year. And we know that some others are starting to just get educated on the topic. So we are absolutely encouraging, and I would absolutely encourage anyone and everybody that is in a position where they are in charge of a website to be all over this and to prepare for it and to focus on mobile. And the next one is near and dear to my heart, digital services tax legislation in Spain and France. So recently, Google told its customers that it's going to raise the rates of adverts in French and Spanish platforms by 2% starting in May. And now this move is not coming out of nowhere. It's basically being done to offset the impact of a digital tax on profits laid on by Google by the French and Spanish governments. So France actually started collecting this tax in 2019, Spain followed suit in 2020, and they did so because these governments were receiving pressure to tax these tech giants, right? Google actually came out and said to the Associated Foreign Press, you know, this rate is to cover part of the cost of conforming to tax laws in these countries. So in short, you know, the taxes are going up, so Google increased their pricing. And it's not great timing. There's a lot of critics behind this, right? We're in the middle of a global pandemic. You know, why would we be increasing this, but you know, again, Google's doing this in response to an increase to them. And Amazon, Apple, they increased their rates in response to the tax last year. So they're not, you know, the only tech giant, right, doing this. But it's also not targeting bodegas, you know, mom and pop shops. It's targeting huge companies, right? 30 million per year annually in France, or $921 million globally. So, you know, and Google warned that this would potentially happen. You know, they came out in February and said taxes on digital services complicate efforts to reach a balanced agreement that worked for all countries. And here we are. And in response to this, there's now rumors that the United States, you know, this is where Facebook, Amazon, Google are headquartered. There's a rumor that U.S. officials are now going to, in turn, throw tariffs at handbags and cosmetics and other goods coming in from France. So, you know, this is likely not the end of this conversation. You know, countries and people are struggling, and you know, the epidemic, if anything, put a microscope on anything like a digital tax law that we may have not really even be talking about if it weren't for, you know, a global pandemic. But you know, what I definitely would want to ask you guys is, you know, what do you think about this news? How do you think other tech giants are also going to respond, and you know, what this means for other countries around the world as well?
I think for me, it's just a reaction on how customers are changing their behavior moving online. I think if you think about, you know, tax clearly in a country is not a particularly sexy subject in any stretch of the imagination, but a country needs to generate cash, right? And if you've had a year of people working from home, like I think, Mike, we were talking about this before, is like, think about how much your gas bill's gone down in your car and how much less tax you've paid because of that, right? Because you're not putting $50 in your car every couple of weeks. So I think it's just countries trying to find ways of generating much needed revenue to keep the country country going. I think for me, I don't necessarily agree with import taxes, right? So people, you know, shipping goods from one country to another and kind of putting levies on those. To me, that stems you know, imports, and clearly it's like trying to drive local trade. But as long as they don't put an import tax on tea from the UK, then life is okay.
Last time that happened, I'm pretty sure that's how the American Revolution started, right?
Potentially, and it might start again if they do it again, because yeah, I need my tea.
Yeah, I mean, Ryan, to this squarely, I don't care for new taxes. I think anytime you get a government taxing a corporation of any type, size, magnitude, there's going to be some push down to users, right? We're probably going to have, in some cases, potentially higher costs in places. However, I don't blame the governments that are doing this. I mean, I think Chris said it well, right? Like, if you used to tax gasoline and other things that were very common tools to get around, the internet's more, you know, prolific than ever before, such a critical tool. I know my bandwidth speeds here have been compromised at parts and times. So I can understand it. I just don't like it. Best way I can describe it. All right. So why don't we change gears from taxation with or without representation over to Twitter. So Chris, Twitter has some interesting new features out. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah. So Twitter held a virtual conference a couple of weeks ago, and we actually spoke about a Twitter subscription model on our last podcast on episode 6. And right after that recording that show, they announced an up-and-coming paid subscription, ultimately, which is called Superfollow, which gives the ability for users to be able to monetize their content. So ultimately, users will soon be able to monetize their tweets. So for a monthly fee, a Superfollow can you know, enable creators to issue perks such as maybe a supporter badge, maybe subscriber-only newsletters, exclusive content, maybe potentially some deals or you know, exclusive community access ultimately to that particular creator, which is the first paid feature that Twitter's offered to its users. And ultimately the creator is getting a proportion of the money, but also so is Twitter. And Twitter used an example within their kind of show of it costing around $4.99 a month. So I think when we last spoke, we said if it was particularly aggressive in terms of cost, then you're not going to get as much traction. $4.99 to me seems pretty reasonable. However, it's $4.99, I guess, per creator that you want to subscribe to. So you're going to be limited in terms of the number that you can do. So Twitter has not offered a timeline for when Superfollow is going to be launched, but I think it's pretty promising. I think it falls in line with some other kind of social networks offering kind of these community-based paid areas. I don't know, Ryan, if you're going to pay $4.99 a month to follow somebody's tweets.
I'm likely not going to pay $4.99 to follow somebody's tweets. But, you know, being I am an avid Twitter user, I basically am on Twitter all day, every day, checking out the news. So it's not foreign to click on a link, whether it's Bloomberg, if you don't have a Bloomberg account, or New York Times, or even like a fantasy baseball content producer. You know, if you want to read who the actual top 10 sleepers are, you know, you have to pay up to for a subscription. So I definitely get it. And the one thing that just kept popping out in my head when I was thinking about this super follow is that subscriptions are everything. They are taking over my life. I have a subscription to everything. Like just in the last year alone, I have a subscription to Peloton. My wife got me a subscription to a brewery in Brooklyn that sends me a 4-pack every month. I have a Farmer's Dog subscription. I have a Whoop subscription, HBO Max. So, you know, this is not going to be foreign to users that they're going to have to pay up to have content, because we're so used to this subscription-based model that's just taken over, you know, how we ingest anything. I'm just not going to do it. If it was $4.99 for quote unquote unlimited, you know, premium content, then I think that makes sense. But $4.99 per super follow is just a little rich for my blood.
Yeah. The $4.99 thing was the example that Twitter used. So I wonder whether, you know, if Ryan had 100,000 followers, maybe he can charge $4.99, but maybe maybe someone else with 1,000 maybe can only charge $1, right? I don't know necessarily if it's going to be $4.99 across the board, but I think, yeah, subscriptions are everything right now. And you see other companies doing it and supporting the creators directly, I think is really important. So The example which they used was journalists, and maybe they're not getting as much revenue, if you will, by working with newspapers as much or whatever it might be, or you have a horrible experience online because they're trying to shove as many adverts on their page as they physically can. Maybe this is a way of supporting them a little bit more.
I would agree. While it doesn't jump to me that I want to sign up for this tomorrow, I think it's a really cool move to the whole like support direct economy that, Chris, we've talked about multiple episodes, right? We've talked about people with supporting YouTube channels directly. We've talked about Patreon, those types of models where you're an individual or you're a company and you produce something that gives someone value and you pay them directly. And there's either no intermediary or it's a very small one. We've seen so many websites and blogs turn to email or newsletter subscription only. We've seen so many podcasts that are behind paywall and subscription only that, Chris, you and I have even argued that what's the value of a podcast if you have to pay for it, right? Because in many senses, it's like radio, right? I think as much as I like the idea of this, I think the fatigue is real. And at some point, you're just going to get a lot of burnout from like, where is something that's, you know, you've known for decades to be free, or at least free with ads to a degree. But I do think if I go a little bit high level for a second, I do think it is a good balanced way to make sure that like everything is not just an ad in your face at this point, right? Because we talked about that before a little bit with Core Vitals, and so much of that technology is like put something in your face so that you can maybe buy a thing. And that's a revenue stream that largely I do like this idea that there are more direct support mechanisms. Do I want to pay $4.99 a month to follow the Washington Post and four of their reporters individually? No, but maybe if there's a coverage deal where I can support an institution and their writers, I think that type of stuff is really cool. So I think I will be irritated as I see these things pop up, but long-term, I do think it's a good evolution to, basically just paying for stuff on the web.
Yeah. And Twitter also announced Twitter communities, which reading about it looks very, very similar to Facebook groups, right? So according to the screenshots shared at the virtual events, it allows users to join in a discussion around a centralized topic, so maybe a soccer team or whatever it might be, and if you're composing a tweet and you're part of that discussion group, users will have the option to share with one or several of the communities that they belong to. So maybe it's not just blasting that tweet into your ether of 100,000 followers, Ryan, but maybe a small subset of those groups. So Twitter said that more information is coming on this later this year, but it seems to me like a more private and controlled way to get your kind of point of view out there. So we'll see on that. And I think it's, again, it will probably benefit those users with a larger subset that are a recognized voice within a particular topic. So if you have a journalist that follows a particular sports team, or a guy that's particularly relevant in the SEO world or something like that, then I guess you'll get your opinion across more to a more centralized audience, which I think is good.
When you put this in there, I loved it for a couple of reasons, right? Like I think Facebook groups are the sleeper hit behind what Facebook is good at in 2020, especially as, you know, people need to try to find different ways to keep themselves either entertained or knowledgeable on a subject. But I got to tell you, from following a diverse group of people on Twitter, it is a madhouse to find the right comments and right replies that actually mean something. It isn't just someone slandering or another person. So any structure Twitter can put behind a topic, a person, an identity, I'm all for it. And I think half the problem why Twitter doesn't appeal to folks like my parents is it's so unstructured that if you can basically put some sort of better back end to curating the good stuff or amplifying the right message that isn't just kind of human interference, I think is really valuable and something. It's nice to see, if I'm just changing subjects for a second, it's nice to see Twitter doing some innovative stuff, because I feel like for years they haven't done much, right? So I think we've cobbled on and said like fleets are pretty lame looking a couple episodes ago. But I mean, I don't remember the last time I've seen Twitter like bring this much stuff to market that's actually caused conversation. So I guess we're getting two news stories in this week. Kudos, Twitter. Yep. You're doing all right.
Making moves. Yeah, the only thing that kind of, I love this too. Ring fencing the information community that you want to be a part of on Twitter. The only thing that popped out was that, you know, this similar things were a huge success for other platforms like a Facebook, but we also saw how problematic they could be, in a year like 2020, right? Misinformation, jumping to the top of the list. So I think that as successful and impactful it could be, it could also in turn be another problem for Twitter, where they have to talk about essentially, you know, blocking not only users like they've done previously, but maybe even communities if there's, you know, if it turns into that much of a problem. So yes, exciting. Twitter is finally making some noise, which is awesome. But I'm sure that there's going to be, ways that they run into some issues as well.
All right, so we got two more stories up for the day, and then we will give you guys some time back. Chris, can you tell us about what is going on with LinkedIn and product tabs?
Yeah, so LinkedIn actually announced, three separate big updates just last week. So in December of 2020, LinkedIn announced something called Product Pages, which is a dedicated space where customers, users, and experts can come together as a community to share various different experiences on a certain product or service that a company offers. They've just announced that they're bringing what they called lead generation forms right to the product page. So lead generation forms let users or companies, let's say, drive more high quality leads through pre-filled in forms using LinkedIn data. So if Mike was interested in a particular product, he can say that he's interested and it would extract his LinkedIn kind of data, if you will, and then pass that to the company. I think that's fantastic, using, you know, building LinkedIn up as more as a community and utilizing that data. So that was update number one. Update number two was LinkedIn Stories, which I think we covered right back at the start of this podcast on episode one. So they announced LinkedIn Stories, which is, as we've mentioned, similar to Fleets or Instagram Stories. They describe it as an easy, lightweight way for members to share everyday professional moments with their community. Personally, I think I've looked at them and the engagement's pretty low. You know, the number of people that have participated there, it doesn't seem as active as maybe Instagram Stories especially, but also the ones on Twitter too. But however, what they've done is they've brought this to company pages as well now. So page admins are able to engage with their customers and their partners by using the story format. However, one thing which I thought was really cool was when a company posting a story, they can use the swipe up feature to direct the audience to a URL. So think, you know, on Instagram stories where you just direct a customer to an external page. And by all accounts, this is available to all pages and all page admins, no matter the size of the following. So on Instagram, it's limited to those accounts with over 10,000 followers. They've just said it's available to everybody, which, looking at LinkedIn overall, is kind of odd because they like to keep people within the platform. So if you post a link within your main post, that doesn't get as much visibility, but they're encouraging it here. I don't know. We'll see how that rolls. So I thought that was interesting. So maybe we'll see some more brands and companies using LinkedIn stories. And then lastly, which is loosely linked to what we were discussing before, LinkedIn have announced the My Company tab. So what page admins can now do is curate content through a recommended tool suggesting articles for their own employees to reshare. So again, think about this as if we had a Marriott Digital Services page or a Marriott International page or a Bright Edge page, the admin for that page could post recommended content and Mike or Chris or Ryan could pick that content up and reshare it directly on our own page. So
I love that.
Which I think is really cool. They've done this because their internal research shows that employees are 60% more likely to engage with posts from coworkers versus non-coworkers. So again, you can see why this is good, and 14 times more likely to share their own organization's page content versus potentially other brands. So basically this My Company tab now makes it easier for companies to recommend it. Marriott actually, I think it was probably about 2 years ago, had an app where it was there was a select group of people that were brought together to, they posted stories on there, and then you could post those on your social channels directly from this app. And the idea was to see how if you could generate more sort of social content out there in the space, and then you had a league table for the amount of content that you generated out there, but then also how many interactions you got or how many comments or likes or whatever it might be. And that was sunset maybe, I don't know, about 6 months into the project. But this is very similar to that. It's kind of encouraging, you know, what content to share. I don't know, Mike, what do you think of that? Do you think you would share more content if it was surfaced up to you?
I do. I love it. I think it's pretty awesome that you, who are significantly becoming a LinkedIn influencer, found this. Because what I've always found really challenging is, like, let's say you're a department like us, right? And you've got a job you're promoting, which is something we very commonly do, right? The back end of basically getting people to share that comment is the most rudimentary thing in the world. It's like you write up an email, you send it out and say, please post this on your LinkedIn, right? And it's like, I think to your point, like, this is the perfect definition of, like, looking at use case from data, building a feature around it, and then propagating it. I think it's great. My only bit of feedback for LinkedIn is, if people start sharing the same type of content or the same piece, don't just push it down to the bottom and say then it's been overshared, right? I think it's a really cool apparatus that I hope they steward the right way and don't just kind of, like, doggedly push all this down and say, oh, it's too much noise. But I do love this concept that they're giving companies tools to get a curated on-brand message out. Because so many times you want to be able to promote, like, here's a new piece of business that the company's doing or a job or a tool, and be able to get people to see that in mass, I think is really cool.
Yeah, I dig it as well. It's, LinkedIn is essentially taking some of the more effective technology pieces from Instagram and Facebook and sort of owning it. And you're right, Mike, and for a company to make a big announcement, sometimes there's a lot of loopholes to go through to create a press release and get PR involved. And now you can just share a story. It's pretty interesting. And then, you know, your colleagues can share said story. And I'm also thinking now too, it's like SNX is coming up. There's lots of larger industry sort of events that are coming up, and whether it's in person or not, you can now be sharing your story from that event. And, you know, historically I would be doing that on Instagram, but, like, that's just for my buddies to see. But now you can be doing it on LinkedIn, so your clients and your colleagues and your partners can also see it. So it's creating a cool interactive social experience on your business profile, which I absolutely love.
Ryan, we got one news story left. And can you tell us, before you take us home, what is going on with Google and the hotel booking section of organic links?
Oh, this is a little bit of news. You guys might be interested. So just like Google did with Google Shopping, Google Flights, the hotel booking section is now offering organic and unpaid links below the paid hotel ad links. Yes, free links. So this is huge, right? It's historically, hotel booking links have been offered via hotel ads, and it was a really successful deployment, right? But now users are going to have more choices, a wider variety of options as they research and eventually book a hotel stay. And it's also potentially leveling the playing field a little bit, right? You don't have to be a huge or even long-standing property in order to be seen when someone is doing research. And Google's even gone so far as to explain what the signals are to determine, you know, why something would be popping up. It's consumer preference, value to the user, landing page experience, and historical accuracy of pricing. So again, this is not too surprising because Google's been doing this in other verticals with shopping and flights, but this is amazing news as we're looking to get the travel and hospitality industry back on track and back to, you know, normal. Google's playing its part, and you know, it's going to be huge for hoteliers too, right? They're going to be able to have a more direct experience with that end user for that online booking experience. So I'm really excited about it. They're clearly going to be continuing to work on it as well as they make it more accessible to everybody. There are going to be some challenges though that I'm sure you guys are aware of. You know, pricing accuracy is likely going to be the biggest one. But at the end of the day, giving a user more options to book for an experience that is meant for them is the name of the game. And you guys must have some sort of thoughts behind this, being that, I don't know, it's what you do every day.
I think for me, this is not Google being nice, right? Google don't do stuff for free. and this is all about Google adapting to the customer need, right? And the customer behavior. So you briefly mentioned it there, but if you look at shopping as a vertical, there's a growing trend of people that are going direct to the shop, right? So if you look at, like, they're going direct to Amazon, they're going direct to Walmart, right? And I even bought something off Walmart had an amazing experience, which is rare from a Walmart perspective. But you can start to see how their business is threatened by people diverting out of Google and going directly to the source. So they're reacting to that, and I think they'll see that as when travel returns, more customers doing that across more verticals, going directly to the provider or going directly to the booking path, such as Expedia or booking.com. So again, they're having to react because the customer need and behavior is changing.
I feel similar. I appreciate Google giving another placement to anybody that wants to take advantage of it. I think it just goes back to a lot of litigation concerns and antitrust stuff that we have seen news for months now, that there's all this desire for Apple, for example, to open up another app store so that people can basically load their own apps in directly. You hear a lot about Facebook in similar spots. And I think any of this antitrust, anti-competitive biasing yourself in your own walled garden stuff, I think we're probably at the point where the dam is starting to break. So just so much of your own world in your own world and what was largely an open web. And I sound like an old guy from the 90s here, but as much as I appreciate it, I've got to believe someone is looking over their shoulder saying, you need to do this. And then to the fact that they even showed, I mean, Ryan, you said it so eloquently, optimization best practices. You've never seen that before, right? And it's like, there's clearly pressure from some government or some organization that's like, open up spots and show people how to do it. So as a marketer, I'm appreciative of it. However, I think it's probably a little bit dubious behind the scenes.
Didn't you guys just trust the process? Can't they just do something nice? I hear you guys. But at the end of the day, I think at least to start, right, it's going to make things easier for the layman to book travel. And that's going to start happening very, very soon and rampantly. Are the big players going to have to respond with their own sort of update or adjustment? Likely. But I think, you know, at first it's absolutely meant for the user, right? So they can book more easily. And it's got to be great for hotels that have been struggling too, because they'll have more direct access to these users.
Well, Ryan, thank you for joining us today for our news roundtable. We want to thank all of our listeners out there who have stayed on this journey with us. If you like what we're talking about, you can follow us on Twitter at MDS_decoded. You can email us at MDS@Marriott.com. And if you liked today's conversation or you didn't, feel free to send us a review. Those really do matter. You've heard a lot of podcasts say that over the air, but the more reviews that you share or write about us, the better chance we have of other people finding this out. So we'll be back in 2 weeks with our next set of topics. But in the meantime, Chris, thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
And Ryan, thank you for joining us today.
Chris and Mike, thanks so much for the opportunity. Appreciate you guys.